Hubble aimed to fulfill his father's wishes, but John Hubble died before Edwin finished his degree. The death of his father encouraged Edwin to ditch law and revisit his childhood passion for astronomy. He left Oxford for the University of Chicago, joined the Yerkes Observatory, and received his PhD in 1917 with a thesis entitled Photographic Investigations of Faint Nebulae. After brief service in the US Army at the end of World War I, Hubble obtained a position at the Mount Wilson Observatory. He found himself at the controls of the largest, most powerful telescope on the planet, and with the knowledge and good sense to point it at the most intriguing and controversial object in the night sky, Andromeda. Just like Curtis before him, Hubble could make out distinct features within the misty patch, but the newly commissioned 100-inch Hooker telescope allowed him to see much more detail. On the 5th of October 1923, he took a 45-minute exposure, found three unidentified specks that he assumed were new novae, and marked them all with an N. To confirm his findings, Hubble needed to compare this plate with previous images of Andromeda taken at Mount Wilson. The following day, he made the journey down to the basement archive where the observatory's collection of images was catalogued and stored. To Hubble's delight, two of the specks were indeed newly discovered novae, what we now know to be the bright nuclear flares of white dwarf stars as they accrete gas and dust from a nearby companion. But it was the third speck that he found most interesting when he compared it to previous images. As Hubble scanned back through the Mount Wilson catalogue, he discovered that the star had been captured before. In some plates it appeared brighter, whereas in others it appeared dim or not present at all. Hubble immediately grasped the importance of his discovery. The third speck was a Cepheid variable, the type of star Henrietta Leavitt had studied two decades earlier. In one of the most famous corrections in scientific history, Hubble crossed out the letter N and replaced it in red ink with the letters VAR, followed by a very understated exclamation mark. Hubble had discovered a cosmic yardstick in Andromeda, and it was a trivial matter to calculate the distance. The new star varied with a period of 31.415 days, which, following Leavitt, implied its intrinsic brightness was 7,000 times that of our sun. And yet it appeared so dim in the night sky that it was invisible to all but the most powerful of telescopes. Hubble's initial calculations revealed that the star was over 900,000 light years away from Earth, a staggering distance when the size of our own galaxy was estimated to be no more than 100,000 light years across. Hubble, with the help of Leavitt's ruler, laid the great debate to rest. Andromeda, the distant patch of light in the night sky, is a galaxy, an island, according to current estimates, of a trillion suns. Current measurements put the giant spiral at a distance of 2.5 million light-years from the Milky Way, one of around 54 galaxies gravitationally bound together to form our galactic neighbourhood, known as the Local Group. The Political Ramifications of Reality, or How to Avoid Getting Locked Up. What is science? There are many answers, and whole academic careers are devoted to a complex analysis of the historical and sociological development of the subject. To a working scientist, however, I think the answer is quite simple and illuminating, because it reveals a lot about how scientists see themselves and what they do. The great, and overused adjective, but not in this case, physicist Richard Feynman gave a characteristically clear and simple description in his Messenger lectures delivered at Cornell University in 1964. In general, we look for a new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we... Now don't laugh, that's really true. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what, if this is right, if this law that we guessed is right, to see what it would imply. And then we compare the computation results to nature, or we say compare to experiment or experience, compare it directly with observations to see if it works. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't make any difference how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't make any difference how smart you are, who made the guess, or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. That's all there is to it.
Why do I like this so much? The reason is that it's modest, almost humble in its simplicity, and this, in my opinion, is the key to the success of science. Science isn't a grandiose practice. There are no great ambitions to understand why we are here, or how the whole universe works, or our place within it, or even how the universe began. Just have a look at something, the smallest, most trivial little thing, and enjoy trying to figure out how it works. That is science.
In a famous BBC Horizon film broadcast in 1982 called The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, Feynman went further. People say to me, "Are you looking for the ultimate laws of physics?" No, I'm not. I'm just looking to find out more about the world, and if it turns out there is a simple ultimate law which explains everything, so be it. That would be very nice to discover. If it turns out it's like an onion with millions of layers and we're just sick and tired of looking at the layers, then that's the way it is. My interest in science is to simply find out more about the world. The remarkable thing about science, however, is that it has ended up addressing some of the great philosophical questions about the origin and fate of the universe and the meaning of existence without actually setting out to do so. And this is no accident. You won't discover anything meaningful about the world by sitting on a pillar for decades and contemplating the cosmos, although you may become a saint. No, a truly deep and profound understanding of the natural world has emerged more often than not from the consideration of much less lofty and profound questions. And there are two reasons for this. Firstly, simple questions can be answered systematically by applying the scientific method as outlined by Richard Feynman, whereas complex and badly posed questions, such as why are we here, cannot. But more importantly, and rather more profoundly, it turns out that the answers to simple questions can overturn centuries of philosophical and theological pontificating quite by accident. Reputations count for naught in the face of observation. The famous story of Galileo's clashes with the Inquisition at the height of the Copernican debate, which he certainly did not expect, nobody does, is the archetypal example. Galileo began his university career with the study of medicine, but his imagination was captured by art and mathematics. Between studying medicine in Pisa and returning to his hometown in 1589 to become professor of mathematics, Galileo spent a year in Florence teaching perspective, and in particular a technique called chiaroscuro. Chiaroscuro is the study of light and shadow, and how it can be used to create a sense of depth by accurately representing the way that light sources illuminate objects. Chiaroscuro was one of the most important new artistic techniques to emerge during Galileo's time, allowing a new sense of realism to be portrayed on canvas. Although Galileo spent only a brief time in Florence, the skills he acquired had a great impact on his scientific work. In particular, his carefully developed ability to understand the delicate play of light on three-dimensional shapes, when applied to his later astronomical studies, played an important role in undermining the Aristotelian cosmological edifice, which formed a cornerstone of the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. The small and seemingly innocuous theological thread on which Galileo unwittingly tugged was made available to him on a visit to Venice in 1609, when he purchased the lenses required to build his first telescope. One of the first objects he turned his perspective tube towards was the moon. With the mind of a mathematician and the eye of an artist, Galileo drew a series of six watercolors representing what he saw. These images are both beautiful and revolutionary. Catholic dogma asserted that the moon and the other heavenly bodies were perfect, unblemished spheres. Previous astronomers who had viewed the moon either with the naked eye or through telescopes had drawn a two-dimensional blotchy surface, but Galileo saw the patterns of light and dark differently. His training in chiaroscuro revealed to him an alien lunar landscape of mountain ranges and craters. I have been led to the conclusion that the surface of the moon is not smooth, even, and perfectly spherical, as the great crowd of philosophers have believed about this and other heavenly bodies,
but on the contrary, to be uneven and rough, and crowded with depression and bulges. And it is like the face of the earth itself, which is marked here and there with chains of mountains and depths of valleys. Galileo shared the watercolours with his long-standing friend from Florence, the artist Cigoli, who was inspired to represent this new and radical view of the moon in the grandest of settings. Built in the year 430 by Pope Sixtus III, the Pauline Chapel in Rome documents the changing artistic styles and techniques used to represent the natural world across many centuries. A place filled with shifting examples of how the three-dimensional world can be represented on a two-dimensional surface. Covering the dome of the Pauline Chapel is Cigoli's final masterpiece, a striking fresco depicting a familiar scene of the Virgin Mary bathed in a shaft of golden light surrounded by cherubs and angels. The fresco depicts Mary over what was, for the first time, a detailed, textured, and cratered moon. The Vatican named it the Assumption of the Virgin, unaware, perhaps, of the philosophical challenge it represented. Here was art representing scientific knowledge, a type of knowledge radically different from historical or scriptural authority, based on observation rather than dogma, and presented unashamedly in a grand setting for all in Rome to see. It is undoubtedly true that Galileo didn't intend to challenge the very theological foundations of the Church of Rome by observing the moon through a telescope. But scientific discoveries, however innocuous they may seem at first sight, have a way of undermining those who don't much care for facts. Reality catches up with everyone eventually. With his depictions of the moon completed, Galileo turned his ever more powerful lenses to other celestial bodies. Between the 7th and the 13th of January 1610, he became the first human to observe Jupiter's four largest moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, now known as the Galilean satellites. For Galileo, this was further evidence to support the work of Copernicus and the physical reality of the heliocentric model. If moons were orbiting Jupiter, Galileo reasoned, it was impossible to argue that the Earth was at the center of the universe, because heavenly bodies existed that did not circle the Earth. Galileo published these observations in the spring of 1610 in The Starry Messenger, and from his correspondence with Kepler, his irritation with the discontent it caused amongst philosophers was clear. "My dear Kepler, I wish that we might laugh at the remarkable stupidity of the common herd. What do you have to say about the principal philosophers of this academy, who are filled with the stubbornness of an asp and do not want to look at either the planets, the moon, or the telescope, even though I have freely and deliberately offered them the opportunity 1,000 times? Truly, just as the asp stops its ears, so do these philosophers shut their eyes to the light of truth." To Galileo's mind, absolute confirmation of Copernicus's heliocentric model was provided by his studies of Venus. Beginning in September 1610, Galileo observed Venus over the course of months, and like the moon, he observed that Venus had phases. Sometimes the planet was lit completely by the sun, but at other times only a crescent appeared to be illuminated. The only plausible explanation for this observation was that Venus was orbiting the sun. This was surely final, compelling evidence of a solar system with the sun at its heart and the planets orbiting around it. It wasn't that simple, of course. Galileo, in what was certainly an ill-judged move, decided to move beyond reporting his scientific observations and instead champion a particular theological and philosophical interpretation of the data, namely that the Church was wrong and that the Earth was most definitely not the centre of the universe. This he seems to have done because he wanted to be famous, and famous he became. Copernicus's De Revolutionibus was banned until corrected. The full version was not removed from the banned list until 1758, and Galileo ordered not to repeat his foolish and absurd conclusions. Galileo didn't keep quiet, and he achieved his historical notoriety by being put under house arrest in 1633, where he stayed for the remainder of his life. Many historians characterize Galileo as a bit of an egotistical social climber who brought it all on himself, which is partly true, and yet also desperately unfair. He was undoubtedly a great scientist and a supremely talented astronomical observer. In particular, he was the first to clearly state the principle of relativity, which lies at the heart of Newton's laws of motion, namely that there is no such thing as absolute rest or absolute motion. This is why we don't feel the movement of the Earth around the Sun, and why Aristotle et al. Were misled into reading far too much into their stationary feelings. In the hands of Albert Einstein, the principle of relativity can be generalized to freely falling objects in a gravitational field, and this ultimately leads to modern cosmology and the Big Bang theory. But we are jumping ahead again. The purpose of recounting the story of Galileo is not to attack the easy target of the Inquisition, which nobody expects. Rather, it is to highlight the fact that the smallest and most modest of scientific observations can lead to great philosophical and theological shifts that in turn can have a tremendous impact on society. Galileo, by looking through a telescope, doing some drawings, and thinking about what he saw, helped to undermine centuries of autocratic idiocy and woolly thinking. In doing so, he got himself locked up, but also bridged the gap between Copernicus and Kepler, and paved the way for Isaac Newton, and ultimately Albert Einstein, to construct a complete description of the universe and our place within it. The happiest thought of my life. Scientific progress, then, is often triggered by rather innocuous discoveries or simple realizations. There's a terrible cliche about scientists exhibiting a childlike fascination with nature, but I can't think of a better way of putting it. The sense in which the cliche rings true is that children are occasionally in the habit of focusing on a very small thing and continuing to ask the question, why, until they get an answer that satisfies their curiosity. Adults don't seem to do this as much. Good scientists do, however. And if I have a thesis in this chapter, then it is as follows. By focusing on tiny but interesting things with honesty and clarity, great and profound discoveries are made, often by flawed human beings who don't initially realize the consequences of their investigations. The absolute archetypal example of such an approach can be found at the beginning of Einstein's quest to replace Newton's theory of gravity. Einstein is most famous for his equation E equals mc squared, which is contained within the special theory of relativity he published in 1905. At the heart of the theory is a very simple concept that dates all the way back to Galileo. Put simply, there is no way that you can tell whether you are moving or not. This sounds a bit abstract, but we all know it's true. If you're sitting in a room at home listening to this book, then it feels the same as if you are sitting in an aircraft listening to this book, as long as there is no turbulence and the aircraft is in level flight. If you aren't allowed to look out of the window, then nothing you can do in the room or on the plane will tell you whether or not you are sitting still or moving. You might claim that your room is self-evidently not moving, whereas a plane obviously is, because otherwise it wouldn't take you from London to New York. But that's not right, because your room is moving in orbit around the Sun, and indeed it is spinning around the Earth's axis, and the Sun itself is in orbit around the galaxy, which is moving relative to other galaxies in the universe. Einstein discovered his famous equation E equals mc squared by taking this seemingly pedantic reasoning seriously and asserting that no experiment you can ever do, even in principle, using clocks, radioactive atoms, electrical circuits, pendulums, or any physical object at all, will tell you whether or not you are moving. Anyone has the absolute right to claim that they are at rest, as long as there is no net force acting on them, causing them to accelerate. You are claiming it now, no doubt, if you are listening to this book sitting comfortably on your sofa. Pedantry is very useful sometimes, because without Einstein's theory of special relativity, we wouldn't have E equals mc squared, we wouldn't really understand nuclear or particle physics, how the sun shines, or how radioactivity works. We wouldn't understand the universe. Something important bothered Einstein after he published his theory in 1905, however. Newton's great achievement, the all-conquering universal law of gravitation, did not fit within the framework of special relativity, and therefore one or the other required modification. Einstein's response to this problem was typically Einsteinian. He thought about it very carefully, and in November 1907, while sitting in his chair in the patent office in Bern, he found the right thread to pull. Looking back at the moment in an article written in 1920, Einstein described his idea with beautiful and indeed childlike simplicity. Then there occurred to me the glücklichste Gedanke meines Lebens, the happiest thought of my life, in the following form. The gravitational field has only a relative existence, in a way similar to the electric field generated by magnetoelectric induction. Because for an observer falling freely from the roof of a house, there exists, at least in his immediate surroundings, no gravitational field, his emphasis. Indeed, if the observer drops some bodies, then these remain relative to him in a state of rest or of uniform motion, independent of their particular chemical or physical nature. In this consideration, the air resistance is, of course, ignored. The observer, therefore, has a right to interpret his state as at rest. I am well aware that you might object quite strongly to this statement, because it appears to violate common sense. Surely an object falling under the action of the gravitational force is accelerating towards the ground, and therefore cannot be said to be at rest. Good, because if you think that, then you're about to learn a valuable lesson. Common sense is completely worthless and irrelevant when trying to understand reality. This is probably why people who like to boast about their common sense tend to rail against the fact that they share a common ancestor with a monkey. How, then, to convince you that Einstein was, and indeed still is, correct? Most of the time, books are better at conveying complex ideas than television. There are many reasons for this, some of which I'll discuss in a future autobiography when my time on TV is long over. But when done well, television pictures can convey ideas with an elegance and economy unavailable in print. Human Universe contains, I hope, some of these moments. But there is one sequence in particular that I think fits into this category. NASA's Plum Brook Station in Ohio is home to the world's largest vacuum chamber. It is 30 meters in diameter and 37 meters high, and was designed in the 1960s to test nuclear rockets in simulated space-like conditions. No nuclear rocket has ever been fired inside. The program was cancelled before the facility was completed. But many spacecraft, from the Skylab nose cone to the airbags on Mars landers, have been tested inside this cathedral of aluminium. To my absolute delight, NASA agreed to conduct an experiment using their vacuum chamber to demonstrate precisely what motivated Einstein to his remarkable conclusion. The experiment involves pumping all the air out of the chamber and dropping a bunch of feathers and a bowling ball from a crane. Both Galileo and Newton knew the result, which is not in question. The feathers and the bowling ball both hit the ground at the same time. Newton's explanation for this striking result is as follows. The gravitational force acting on a feather is proportional to its mass. We've already seen this written down in Newton's law of gravitation. That gravitational force causes the feather to accelerate, according to Newton's other equation, F equals ma. This equation says that the more massive something is, the more force has to be applied to make it accelerate. Magically, the mass that appears in F equals ma is precisely the same as the mass that appears in the law of gravitation, and so they precisely cancel each other out. In other words, the more massive something is, the stronger the gravitational force between it and the Earth, but the more massive it is, the larger this force has to be to get it moving. Everything cancels out, and so everything ends up falling at the same rate. The problem with this explanation is that nobody has ever thought of a good reason why these two masses should be the same. In physics, this is known as the equivalence principle, because gravitational mass and inertial mass are precisely equivalent to each other. Einstein's explanation for the fact that both the feathers and the bowling ball fall at the same rate in the Plum Brook vacuum chamber is radically different. Recall Einstein's happiest thought. Because for an observer falling freely from the roof of a house, there exists no gravitational field. There is no force acting on the feathers or the ball in free fall, and therefore they don't accelerate. They stay precisely where they are, at rest relative to each other. Or if you prefer, they stand still because we are always able to define ourselves as being at rest if there are no forces acting on us. But, you are surely asking, how come they eventually hit the ground if they are not moving because no forces are acting on them? The answer, according to Einstein, is that the ground is accelerating up to meet them and hits them like a cricket bat. But, you must be thinking, I'm sitting on the ground now and I'm not accelerating. Oh, yes, you are, and you know it because you can feel a force acting on you. It's the force exerted by the chair on which you may be sitting, or the ground on which you are standing. This is obvious. If you stand up long enough, then your feet will hurt, because there is a force acting on them. And if there is a force acting on them, then they are accelerating. There's no sleight of hand here. The very beautiful thing about Einstein's happiest thought is that once you know it, it's utterly obvious. Standing on the ground is hard work, because it exerts a force on you. The effect is precisely the same as sitting in an accelerating car and being pushed back into your seat. You can feel the acceleration viscerally. And if you switch off your common sense for a moment, then you can feel the acceleration now. The only way you can get rid of the acceleration, momentarily, is to jump off a roof. This is wonderful reasoning, but of course it does raise the thorny question of why, if there is no such thing as gravity, the Earth orbits the Sun. Maybe Aristotle was right after all. The answer is not easy, and it took Einstein almost a decade to work out the details. The result, published in 1916, is the General Theory of Relativity, which is often cited as the most beautiful scientific theory of them all. General relativity is notoriously mathematically and conceptually difficult when you get into the details of making predictions that can be compared with observations. Indeed, most physics students in the UK will not meet general relativity until their final year or until they become postgraduates. But having said that, the basic idea is very simple. Einstein replaced the force of gravity with geometry, in particular, the curvature of space and time. Imagine that you are standing on the surface of the Earth at the equator with a friend. You both start walking due north, parallel to each other. As you get closer to the North Pole, you will find that you move closer together, and if you carry on all the way to the pole, you will bump into each other. If you don't know any better, then you may conclude that there is some kind of force pulling you both together. But in reality, there is no such force. Instead, the surface of the Earth is curved into a sphere, and on a sphere, lines that are parallel at the equator meet at the pole. They are called lines of longitude. This is how geometry can lead to the appearance of a force. Einstein's theory of gravity contains equations that allow us to calculate how space and time are curved by the presence of matter and energy, and how objects move across the curved space-time, just like you and your friend moving across the surface of the Earth. Space-time is often described as the fabric of the universe, which isn't a bad term. Massive objects such as stars and planets tell the fabric how to curve, and the fabric tells objects how to move. In particular, all objects follow straight-line paths across the curved space-time that are known in the jargon as geodesics. This is the general relativistic equivalent of Newton's first law of motion. Every body continues in a state of rest or uniform motion in a straight line unless acted upon by a force. Einstein's description of the Earth's orbit around the Sun is therefore quite simple. The orbit is a straight line in space-time, curved by the presence of the Sun. And the Earth follows this straight line because there are no forces acting on it to make it do otherwise. This is the opposite of the Newtonian description, which says that the Earth would fly through space in what we would intuitively call a straight line if it were not for the force of gravity acting between it and the Sun. Straight lines in curved space-time look curved to us for precisely the same reason that lines of longitude on the surface of the Earth look curved to us. The space upon which the straight lines are defined is curved. This is all well and good, but there may be a question that's been nagging away in your mind since I told you that the ground accelerated up and hit the feathers and the bowling ball at Plumbrook like a cricket bat. How could it possibly be that every piece of the Earth's surface is accelerating away from its center, and yet the Earth stays intact as a sphere with a fixed radius? The answer is that if a little piece of the Earth's surface at Plumbrook were left to its own devices, it would do precisely the same thing as the feather and the bowling ball. It would follow a straight line through space-time. These straight lines point radially inwards towards the centre of the Earth. This is the state of rest, if you like, the natural trajectory that would be followed by anything. The geodesics point radially inwards because of the way that the mass of the Earth curves space-time. So a collapsing Earth would be the natural state of things without any forces acting, one in which ultimately all the matter would collapse into a little black hole. The thing that prevents this from happening is the rigidity of the matter that makes up the Earth, which ultimately has its origin in the force of electromagnetism and a quantum mechanical effect called the Pauli exclusion principle. In order to stay as a big spherical Earth-sized ball, a force must act on each little piece of ground, and this must cause each little piece of ground to accelerate. Every piece of big spherical things like planets must continually accelerate radially outwards to stay as they are, according to general relativity. From what I've said so far, it might seem that general relativity is simply a pleasing way of explaining why the Earth orbits the Sun and why objects all fall at the same rate in a gravitational field. General relativity is far more than that, however. Very importantly, it makes precise predictions about the behaviour of certain astronomical objects that are radically different from Newton's. One of the most spectacular examples is a binary star system known rather less than poetically as PSR J0348 plus 0432. The two stars in this system are exotic astrophysical objects. One is a white dwarf, the core of a dead star held up against the force of gravity by a sea of electrons. Electrons behave according to the Pauli exclusion principle, which, roughly speaking, states that electrons resist being squashed together. This purely quantum mechanical effect can halt the collapse of a star at the end of its life, leaving a super-dense blob of matter. White dwarfs are typically between 0.6 and 1.4 times the mass of our Sun, but with a volume comparable to that of the Earth. The upper limit of the mass of a white dwarf is known as the Chandrasekhar limit, and was first calculated by the Indian astrophysicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar in 1930. The calculation is a tour de force of modern physics, and relates the maximum mass of these exotic objects to four fundamental constants of nature: Newton's gravitational constant, Planck's constant, the speed of light, and the mass of the proton. After almost a century of astronomical observations, no white dwarf has ever been discovered that exceeds the Chandrasekhar limit. Almost all the stars in the Milky Way, including our Sun, will end their lives as white dwarfs. Only the most massive stars will produce a remnant that exceeds the Chandrasekhar limit, and the vast majority of these will produce an even more exotic object known as a neutron star. In the PSR J0348 plus 0432 system, quite wonderfully, the white dwarf has a neutron star companion, and this is what makes the system so special. If the remains of a star exceed the Chandrasekhar limit, the electrons are squashed so tightly onto the protons in the star that they can react together via the weak nuclear force to produce neutrons with the emission of a particle called a neutrino. Through this mechanism, the whole star is converted into a giant atomic nucleus. Neutrons, just like electrons, obey the Pauli exclusion principle and resist being squashed together, leading to a stable, dead star. Neutron stars can have masses several times that of our Sun, but quite astonishingly are only around 10 kilometres in diameter. They are the densest stars known. A teaspoonful of neutron star matter weighs as much as a mountain. Imagine for a moment this exotic star system. The white dwarf and neutron star are very close together. They orbit around each other at a distance of 830,000 kilometres, that's around twice the distance to the Moon, once every 2 hours and 27 minutes. That's an orbital velocity of around 2 million kilometres per hour. The neutron star is twice the mass of our Sun, around 10 kilometres in diameter, and spins on its axis 25 times a second. This is a star system of unbelievable violence. Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts that the two stars should spiral in towards each other because they lose energy by disturbing space-time itself, emitting what are known as gravitational waves. The loss of energy is minuscule, resulting in a change in orbital period of 8 millionths of a second per year. In a triumph of observational astronomy, using the giant Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico, the Effelsberg telescope in Germany, and the European Southern Observatory's VLT in Chile, astronomers measured the rate of orbital decay of PSR J0348 plus 0432 in 2013 and found it to be precisely as Einstein predicted. This is quite remarkable. Einstein could never have dreamt of the existence of white dwarfs and neutron stars when he had his happiest thought in 1907. And yet by thinking carefully about falling off a roof, he was able to construct a theory of gravity that describes with absolute precision the behavior of the most exotic star system accessible to 21st century telescopes. And that, if I really need to say it, is why I love physics. Einstein's theory of general relativity has, at the time of writing, passed every precision test that scientists have been able to carry out in the century since it was first published. From the motion of feathers and bowling balls in the Earth's gravitational field to the extreme astrophysical violence of PSR J0348 plus 0432, the theory comes through with flying colours. There is rather more to Einstein's magisterial theory than the mere description of orbits, however. General relativity is fundamentally different from Newton's theory because it doesn't simply provide a model for the action of gravity. Rather, it provides an explanation for the existence of the gravitational force itself in terms of the curvature of space-time. It's worth writing down Einstein's field equations because they are, to be honest, deceptively simple. G mu nu equals 8 pi gt mu nu. Here, the right side describes the distribution of matter and energy in some region of space-time, and the left-hand side describes the shape of space-time as a result of the matter and energy distribution. To calculate the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, one would put a spherical distribution of mass with the radius of the Sun into the right-hand side of the equation, and, roughly speaking, out would pop the shape of space-time around the Sun. Given the shape of space-time, the orbit of the Earth can be calculated. It's not completely trivial to do this by any means, and the notation above hides great complexity. But the point is simply that given some distribution of matter and energy, Einstein's equations let you calculate what space-time looks like. But here is the remarkable point that draws us towards the end of our story. Einstein's equations deal with the shape of space-time, the fabric of the universe. The first thing to note is that we are dealing with space-time, not just space. Space is not a fixed arena within which things happen with a big universal clock marking some sort of cosmic time upon which everyone agrees. The fabric of the universe, in Einstein's theory, is a dynamical thing. Very importantly, therefore, Einstein's equations don't necessarily describe something that is static and unchanging. The second thing to note is that nowhere have we restricted the domain of Einstein's theory to the region of space-time around a single star, or even a double star system such as PSR J0348 plus 0432. Indeed, there is no suggestion in Einstein's theory that such a restriction is necessary. Einstein's equations can be applied to an unlimited region of space-time. This implies that they can, at least in principle, be used to describe the shape and evolution of the entire universe. A Day Without Yesterday. Storytelling is an ancient and deeply embedded human impulse. We learn, we communicate, we connect across generations through stories. We use them to explore the minutiae of human life, taking delight in the smallest things. And we tell grander tales of origins and endings. History is littered with stories about the creation of the universe. They seem as old as humanity itself. Multifarious gods, cosmic eggs, worlds emerging from chaos or order, from the waters or the sky or nothing at all. There exist as many creation myths as there are cultures. The impulse to understand the origin of the universe is clearly a powerful unifying idea, although the very existence of many different mythologies continues to be a source of division. It's an unfortunate testament to the emotional power of creation narratives that so much energy is spent arguing about old ones rather than using the increasingly detailed observational evidence available to 21st century citizens to construct new ones. We live in a very privileged and exciting time in this sense, because observational evidence for creation stories was scant even a single lifetime ago. When my grandparents were born in Oldham at the turn of the 20th century, there was no scientific creation story. Astronomers were not even aware of a universe beyond the Milky Way, which makes it all the more remarkable that the modern scientific approach to the description of the universe emerged almost fully formed from Einstein's theory of general relativity before Edwin Hubble published the discovery of his Cepheid variable star in Andromeda and settled Shapley and Curtis's great debate. One of the beautiful things about mathematical physics is that equations contain stories. If you think of equations in terms of the nasty little things you used to solve at school on a damp autumn afternoon, then that may sound like a strange and abstract idea. But equations like Einstein's field equations are much more complex animals. Recall that Einstein's equations will tell you the shape of space-time, given some distribution of matter and energy. That shape is known as a solution of the equations, and it is these solutions that contain the stories. The first exact solution to Einstein's field equations was discovered in 1915 by the German physicist Karl Schwarzschild. Schwarzschild used the equations to calculate the shape of space-time around a perfectly spherical, non-rotating mass. Schwarzschild's solution can be used to describe planetary orbits around a star, but it also contains some of the most exotic ideas in modern physics. It describes what we know now as the event horizon of a black hole. The well-known tales of astronauts being spaghettified as they fall towards oblivion inside a supermassive collapsed star are to be found in Schwarzschild's solution. The calculation was a remarkable achievement, not least because Schwarzschild completed it whilst serving in the German army at the Russian front. Shortly afterwards, the 42-year-old physicist died of a disease contracted in the trenches. The most remarkable stories waiting to be found inside Einstein's equations reveal themselves when we take an audacious and seemingly reckless leap. Instead of confining ourselves to describing the space-time around spherical blobs of matter, why not think a little bigger? Why not try to use Einstein's equations to tell us about all of space-time? Why can't we apply general relativity to the entire universe? Einstein noticed this as a possibility very early in the development of his theory, and in 1917 he published a paper entitled Cosmological Considerations of the General Theory of Relativity. It's a big step, of course, from thinking about someone falling off a roof to telling the story of the universe, and Einstein appears to have been uncharacteristically wobbly. In a letter to his friend Paul Ehrenfest, a few days before he presented his paper to the Prussian Academy, he wrote, "I have, again, perpetrated something about gravitation theory, which somewhat exposes me to the danger of being confined in a madhouse." The universe modelled in Einstein's 1917 paper is not the one we inhabit, but the paper is of interest for the introduction of what Einstein later came to view as a mistake. Einstein tried to find a solution to his equations that would describe a finite universe, populated by a uniform distribution of matter and stable against gravitational collapse. At the time, this was a reasonable thing to do because astronomers knew of only a single galaxy, the Milky Way, and the stars did not appear to be collapsing inwards towards each other. Einstein also seems to have had a particular story in mind. He felt that an eternal universe was more elegant than one that had a beginning, which left open the thorny question of a creator. He discovered, however, that general relativity does not allow for a universe with stars, planets, and galaxies to be eternal. Instead, his solution told the story of an unstable universe that would collapse inwards. Einstein tried to solve this unfortunate problem by adding a new term in his equations known as the cosmological constant. This extra term can act as a repulsive force, which Einstein adjusted to resist the tendency of his model universe to collapse under its own gravity. Later, he is famously said to have remarked to his friend George Gamow that the cosmological constant was his biggest blunder. As physicists began to search for solutions to Einstein's equations, more and more possible universes were discovered. None, with the exception of Einstein's universe and a universe without matter and dominated by a positive cosmological constant, discovered in 1917 by Willem de Sitter, was static. We will return to de Sitter's universe in a moment, but in every other case, Einstein's equations seem to imply continual evolution, whereas Einstein himself felt that the universe should be unchanging and eternal. As more physicists worked with the equations, things only got worse for Einstein's static, eternal universe. The first exact cosmological solution of Einstein's equations for a realistic universe filled with galaxies was discovered by Russian physicist Alexander Friedman in 1922. He reached his result by assuming something that takes us all the way back to the beginning of this chapter, a Copernican universe, in the sense that nowhere in space is special. This is known as the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy, and it corresponds to solving Einstein's equations with a completely uniform matter distribution. This may seem to be a gross oversimplification, and in the early 1920s, the extent to which this assumption agreed with the observational evidence, a universe seemingly containing just a single galaxy, was tenuous. From a theoretical perspective, however, Friedman's assumption makes perfect sense. It's the simplest assumption one can make, and it makes it relatively easy to do the sums. So relatively easy, in fact, that Friedman's work was replicated and extended quite independently by a Belgian mathematician and priest named Georges Lemaître. Lemaître planted his flag firmly in the no-man's land between religion and science, a strip of intellectual land occupied, whether we like it or not, by cosmology. A student of Harlow Shapley, this deeply religious man never saw a conflict between these two very different modes of human thought. He embodies the much-debated and criticized modern notion introduced by the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria, asking the same questions but operating within separate domains. My view is that this is far too simplistic a position to take. Questions concerning the origin of the physical universe are of the same character as questions about the nature of the gravitational force or the behavior of subatomic particles, and answers will surely be found by employing the methodology of science. Having said that, I am willing to recognize that romance, or wonder, or whatever the term is for that deep feeling of awe when contemplating the universe in all its immensity, is a central component of both religious and scientific experience. And perhaps there is room for both in providing the inspiration for the exploration of nature. At least this is what Lemaître felt, and he used his twin perspectives as a guide on his intellectual journey through the cosmos throughout his distinguished career. Ordained a priest in 1923 while studying at the Catholic University in Louvain, Lemaître studied physics and mathematics alongside some of the great physicists and astronomers of the time, including Arthur Eddington and Harlow Shapley, from the University of Cambridge to Harvard and MIT, before returning to Belgium in 1925 to work with Einstein's general relativity. Lemaître never met Alexander Friedman, who died from typhoid in 1925. They never spoke or corresponded, and Lemaître was almost certainly unaware of the obscure paper Friedman had published describing a dynamic and changing universe. He followed the same intellectual path, however, assuming an isotropic and homogeneous distribution of matter in the cosmos, and searching for solutions to Einstein's equations that describe the story of this smooth and uniform universe. And of course, he came to the same conclusion. Such a universe cannot be static. It must either expand or contract. Lemaître met Einstein at the 1927 Solvay conference in Brussels and told him of his conclusions. "Your calculations are correct, but your physics insight is abominable," snapped the great man. Einstein was wrong. By 1931, Lemaître was writing papers containing wonderfully vivid phrases and making clear his view that Einstein's theory requires a moment of creation, a big bang. He writes of a day without yesterday and of the universe emerging from a primeval atom. In 1934, the Princeton physicist Howard Percy Robertson catalogued all of the possible solutions to Einstein's equations given a uniform distribution of matter throughout the cosmos, a perfect Copernican principle according to which no place in the cosmos is special or significant. The models containing matter tend to describe either an expanding or contracting universe, and therefore suggest a quite wonderful thing. There may have been a day without a yesterday. Einstein's equations contain within them a scientific creation story, even though their author himself resisted it. The story of Einstein's theory of general relativity, and its subsequent application to the whole universe, delivers a compelling narrative illustrating the power of physics. The theory, inspired by thinking about a man falling off a roof, predicts that there was a moment of creation. No experimental measurements are required, and no observations need be made other than that things fall at the same rate in a gravitational field. There are multiple layers of irony here. The idea that such progress towards answering the most profound questions about our origins can be made by thinking alone is almost Aristotelian, a partial throwback to the lofty authority of the classical world that Bruno, Copernicus, and Galileo did so much to overturn. That the equations seem to describe a universe with a necessary moment of creation, lending support, at least in Lemaître's eyes, to the notion of a creator, would also appear to bring us full circle and back to Bormann, Lovell, and Anders and the creation stories of old. Indeed, Pope Pius XII, on hearing about the new cosmology, said, "True science to an ever-increasing degree discovers God, as though God was waiting behind each door opened by science." Einstein, to his deep chagrin, having thrown a blanket of rational thought across a landscape of mythology, appeared to have replaced one creation story with another. To finish the story of our magnificent relegation, let me briefly address these points. The theoretical prediction of an expanding universe does, of course, require experimental verification, and this came rapidly. On the 15th of March 1929, Edwin Hubble published a paper entitled "A Relation Between Distance and Radial Velocity Among Extragalactic Nebulae," in which he reported his observation that all galaxies beyond our local group are rushing away from us. Moreover, the more distant the galaxy, the higher its speed of recession. This is precisely what an expanding universe, as predicted by Einstein's theory, should look like. In 1948, Alpha, Beta, and Gamow published a famous paper with the coolest author list in the history of physics, which showed how the observed abundance of light chemical elements in the universe could be calculated assuming a very hot, dense phase in the early history of the universe. Modern calculations of these abundances are extremely precise and agree perfectly with astronomical observations. Perhaps most compellingly of all, the afterglow of the Big Bang, known as the cosmic microwave background radiation, also predicted by Alpha and Hermann in 1948, was discovered by Penzias and Wilson in 1964. We will have much to say about the cosmic microwave background in the following chapters. For now, it is sufficient to say that the discovery that the universe is still glowing at a temperature of 2.7 degrees above absolute zero was the final evidence that convinced even the most skeptical scientists that the Big Bang theory was the most compelling model for the evolution of the universe. What, though, of the thorny question of the cause of the Big Bang itself? What was the origin of Lemaître's primeval atom? Did God really do it? The standard Big Bang cosmology of the 20th century has no answer to this question, but 21st century cosmology does. We will address the current scientific understanding of what happened before the Big Bang later on, but let me offer a tantalizing hint here. It is now thought that before the Big Bang, the universe underwent a period of exponential expansion known as inflation. In this time, the universe behaved in accord with de Sitter's matterless solution to Einstein's equations discovered in 1917. This period of rapid expansion gave us the homogeneous and isotropic distribution of matter we see today on large distance scales, which is the reason why Friedmann and Lemaître's simple Copernican assumptions lead to a description of the evolution of the universe after the Big Bang that fits observational data perfectly. There are no special places in the universe because the early inflationary expansion smoothed everything out. When inflation stopped, the energy contained within the field that drove it was dumped back into the universe, creating all the matter and radiation we observe today. Small fluctuations in the inflation field seeded the formation of the galaxies, uniformly distributed across the sky in their billions, each containing countless worlds, quite possibly without end beyond the visible horizon. In the words of Georges Lemaître, "Standing on a well-cooled cinder, We see the slow fading of the suns, and we try to recall the vanished brilliance of the origin of the worlds. Our cinder is not special. It is insignificant in size, one world amongst billions in one galaxy amongst trillions. But it has been a tremendous ascent into insignificance, because by the virtuous combination of observation and thought, we have been able to discover our place. How Giordano Bruno would have loved what we found. Chapter 2. Are we alone? Sometimes I think we are alone in the universe, and sometimes I think we're not. In either case, the idea is quite staggering. Arthur C. Clarke. Science fact or fiction? There are questions to which knowing the answers would have a profound cultural effect. The question of our solitude is one. Are we alone in the universe? Yes or no? One of these is true. The question as posed isn't a good